الله مولانا دايما الله مولانا دايما الله مولانا دايما الله مولانا انظروا العربي مولاي محمد انظروا المصطفى نبينا نبينا حارس القيامة مولاي محمد الشفاع في الأمة مولاي محمد دايما الله مولانا دايما الله مولانا نبينا 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 صلي ولي عربي العربي عربي صلي ولي
A master of the Gimbri and Oud and a world-renowned proponent of Gnawa music, that's Morocco's Majid Bekkaas with Daimala. It's from his acclaimed 2001 album, African Gnawa Blues. Bekkaas, heavily influenced by U.S. jazz and blues, also is known for blending traditional music styles from all over the world into his own. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, helps to fine-tune our focus with a synopsis of issues and developments that mattered in 2015 and that one will assume will continue to matter in the new year. Dr. Horn, as you know, is no stranger to Lead Stories. We have him as, we're lucky to have him and privileged to have him as our Analyst of World Affairs. Dr. Horn is the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and he has been with us many times discussing matters of great importance and presenting those issues and events from a unique perspective. He is the author of more than 30 books, the most recent of which we discussed here, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic. It is appropriate that we start off our series of analyses of events this early in the year with Dr. Horn. And Gerald, I thank you so much for being with us today. And do I say?
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being with us. Well, suppose you start off by telling us from your perspective what you considered to be some of the most important and significant developments of 2015 that continue to loom large and will continue to loom large in 2016?
Well, first of all, domestically, the spate of police killings, particularly of black people in the United States of America, garnered justifiably many headlines, and that will continue to loom large in 2016, not only because, sadly and tragically, I expect more, but also because within days, a United Nations investigation team will be descending upon the United States to look into this spate of police terror. Secondly, and this is related to issue number one, I would say the continued flexing of the muscles of the white right in the United States, which also has global implications, as we shall see shortly, that is not only reflected in the continuing rise of Donald J. Trump, but it's also manifested in the fact that congressional Republicans are turning a blind eye, if not cheerleading, when their comrades violate the law. I'm not only speaking of Kim Davis, the Kentucky clerk who refused to ratify same-sex marriages, but also what's happening in eastern Oregon. This is a very dangerous trend, and what's interesting is that the mainstream press has been talking more about the F-word, fascism, lately, actually, in some ways, much more so than the domestic press. I mean, the left-wing press, which is equally troubling. Now, on the international scene, the civilian nuclear deal with Iran was of maximum importance. I'm speaking of the deal that was brokered not only by the United States and Germany, but the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, Britain, France, China, and Russia, which Iran thus far has been sticking to the consternation of many in the neoconservative movement. If you look at the current issue of Foreign Affairs published by the Elite Council on Foreign Relations headquartered in Manhattan, you'll find a very disturbing article co-authored by Elliot Cohen, a former advisor to both Mitt Romney and George W. Bush, basically calling for what he terms, quote, political warfare, unquote, against Tehran, and advocating a number of highly provocative measures that in many ways would, could and would lead to a conflict between Iran and the United States. Obviously, we need to see the current conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran in that context, which ties into another major issue of 2015, which is the continued fall of the price of a barrel of petroleum, which is having manifest consequences all over the world. It's obviously wounded Venezuela. It's wounding Russia. It's also wounding Houston, Texas, the self-proclaimed energy capital of the United States, with bankruptcies increasing along with layoffs. It's been a boon, of course, to U.S. consumers and drivers who see the price of the pump go in many cities below $2 a gallon. But I think that many in the oil industry feel that they cannot go on like this, that a manufactured crisis, not least a war on Iran, which is about to flood the market with even more oil product, which will drive the price of a barrel of oil down even further, that is of maximum concern. And a war, in many ways, could lead to a panic driving up the price of a barrel of oil, helping to revive the Houston energy industry, but also having the consequence, perhaps, of helping the Maduro government in Venezuela and the Putin government in Russia. So it's really a crapshoot. So those are just a few of the key issues that I see for 2015 leading into 2016.
Well, I want to backtrack from where you started, the police killings, which you described as police terror, and the flexing of the muscles of the white right. I've talked about this, and I assure the audience I've not discussed with Gerald Horn what these subjects are going to be. I never do tell people or ask people, what are you going to say? But it is interesting that there is a strong reflection and the same view that emerges. And people would say, well, why do you, Gerald Horn, why do you, Eutrice Lead, why do you come up with these topics as being some of the most significant of 2015, police killings and the rise of fascism? Why are we thinking this way? Certainly these have been stories in the media, they've been covered, but why do you see the dovetailing here?
Well, it should be self-evident. I mean, first of all, we live in a country that was founded on slavery of Africans and white supremacy that tolerated Jim Crow. And I might also add that in order for slavery to be abolished, it took not only domestic movements, but also international movements. That is to say, you needed significant external factors to get these folk in the United States to move away from slavery. And the same thing is true for Jim Crow. And that's why it's so disturbing to me that more people are not thinking the way that we are thinking. I mean, for example, if you look at the mainstream press, which understandably and justifiably has been ringing the bell about the rise of fascism, right-wing populism, particularly Dana Milbank and the Washington Post. But what's striking is they rarely connect that to U.S. history. It's almost like it's come out of the blue. And with regard to the left in the United States, the left in the United States tends to have a very naive view of this country. That is to say, they swallow the Kool-Aid with regard to this country being founded on these principles of freedom and liberty, and then everything that happens subsequent to the founding, the genocide against the Native Americans, colonialism in Puerto Rico, genocidal wars in Vietnam and Korea, supporting apartheid South Africa, all that supposedly in violation of these founding principles, which barely passes the giggle test. And there is also a reluctance to analyze the political trajectory of the white working class. One of the more significant developments in 2015 was the study co-authored by Princeton Nobel laureate Angus Deaton and his spouse Hannah Case, which suggested that the mortality rates of Euro-Americans without high school degrees or barely a high school degree is plummeting precipitously. As a matter of fact, even though there's still a gap between, say, the white working class mortality rates and the black and Latino, on the other hand, the gap is closing. And the way the mortality rates are rising is through suicide, through opiate addiction, through alcohol poisoning, etc., which bespeaks a certain kind of political despair. And at the same time, the mainstream press has been very keen to report that the crowds who are flocking to the rallies of Donald J. Trump are precisely people from this cohort. Now, it's very difficult, it seems to me, for many of our friends on the left to analyze this phenomenon. I think our friends on the left are very good at pinning the tail on the donkey, that is to say, castigating the Democrats or castigating Obama, who, of course, deserve castigation, not least because of the disastrous war in Libya, which has led to ISIS gaining a foothold in North Africa. But you can't, on the one hand, talk about the United States being a, quote, democracy on the one hand, and on the other hand, not talking about the masses of people when you make a political analysis and just act as if a president is an emperor who acts on his own without any sort of push or impetus from either the 1% or the 99%. So this is one of the reasons why it's very easy to be rather pessimistic about 2016 and where the United States is going during this pivotal year.
Well, it's going very, very quickly into serious presidential mode. And we have, of course, begun the election year itself, culminating in November. How do you see the what I think is the absence of an alternative here politically? And particularly the third parties, or is it a foregone conclusion that they will not be a factor in this election? And where does the blame lie for this?
I'm not sure if it's a foregone conclusion, but I do think that we should think seriously about the fact that the person who will probably be elected U.S. president in November will probably be to the right of the current incumbent. That is to say that the United States as a country seems to be moving steadily to the right. I assume that the Green Party or another third party will be running a presidential candidate, but if history is any guide, at best, such a third party can expect to get optimistically 2% of the vote nationally and not win any states in this electoral college system. Clearly, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont has struck a chord, but as of today, it does not appear as if he will prevail in terms of getting the Democratic Party nomination. And this is the case even though he seems to be doing quite well in the polls in Iowa and in New Hampshire, particularly with his talk about restraining the 1%, restraining the billionaire class, raising taxes, breaking up the big banks, the zombie banks, restoring Glass-Steagall, that is to say the wall between investment banking and commercial banking, that removal of that wall, as you recall, was a precipitating factor in the economic collapse of 2008 that led to the election of President Obama. And because it does appear that whoever is elected in November will be to the right of the current incumbent, this obviously calls into question many of the current incumbent's policies. I've already made reference to the civilian nuclear deal with Iran. It's not a treaty. It was not submitted to Congress. And therefore, it might make it easy prey for either a Republican president or even Hillary Rodham Clinton, who, as you know, for whatever reason, feels she has to portray herself as a hawk. Likewise, with regard to the improvement in relations with Cuba, we should take note of the fact that two of the leading GOP presidential candidates, Marco Rubio of Florida and Ted Cruz of Texas, who, by the way, now is considered the odds on favorite to win the nomination, assuming Donald Trump stumbles, you can expect both of these Cuban Americans to move very aggressively against this attempt by President Obama to improve relations with Cuba. Likewise, with regard to the Paris summit on climate change, which the United States played a pivotal role in helping to bring to a conclusion that was not necessarily satisfactory to many of our friends in the environmental movement, but certainly was outrageous to many in the Republican Party, many of whom don't accept the science of climate change, many of whom feel that moving towards a fossil fuel-free future would be terribly wounding to the energy sector in the United States and to investments in ExxonMobil and the major energy giants. And what this also reflects is the point that we mentioned at the top of this program, which is that the white right, which is obviously a clear and present danger to the black community as manifested in police killings and lack of indictments, such as the Tamir Rice case in Cleveland, you could say that they're also a threat to human existence with their objection to the science of climate change, which caused President Obama not to submit the language of the Paris summit to the Senate as a treaty because he felt it would be filibustered or even voted down, which therefore gives it less legal rigor than it would have otherwise. And so these are issues we obviously have to contend with.
I want to talk about a question of ideology in the presidential election. Bernie Sanders has situated himself as a democratic socialist and therefore very different from your run-of-the-mill standard-issue Democrat. Do you identify in Bernie Sanders any telltale signs of democratic socialism?
Oh, sure. Particularly in the U.S. context, I have to say, in a country as right-wing as this one, in a country where the Euro-American majority not only tends to lean to the right, but then drag the rest of us along with them as we try to fight off their backwards ideology, I find it quite courageous for Bernie Sanders to identify himself with the S-word. I find it quite courageous that he tends to try to identify himself with social democracy in the Scandinavian countries. Now, of course, because the United States is a ideologically backwards, retrograde country, which affects each and every one of us to a greater or lesser degree, obviously there are certain objections we can make to some of the positions that Bernie Sanders has taken, particularly on foreign policy. I think at the last debate, Hillary Clinton pointed out that, like many of our friends on the left, he signed on to that escapade in Libya, which has to be the biggest foreign policy disaster of the Obama administration, since, after all, he inherited the disasters from Iraq and Afghanistan, but then added his own mini version by leading the invasion of Libya that Bernie Sanders signed on to. But once again, I would not like to single out Bernie Sanders for particular derision or critique because I think he reflects a wider phenomenon. I mean, for example, I'm speaking to you right now from Duke University, where I'm doing research on a book on the movement that led to the first democratic elections in South Africa in the spring of 1994, which I consider, along with the Haitian Revolution, one of the most significant events in the history of the Pan-African world. Now, I was just looking at materials that suggested that as the white minority regime was going into crisis in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, that immigration from Poland and Hungary and even Russia accelerated, which is curious because, as you know, there are many people in the anti-apartheid movement who are doing cheerleading for those anti-communist movements in Eastern Europe. At the same time, these people were anti-apartheid. And it turns out, of course, that a Polish immigrant assassinated Chris Hani, who was to the left of Nelson Mandela, probably the second most popular leader in South Africa in the run-up to the 1994 elections, which helped to set back South Africa ideologically. So as I was going through these materials, I was thinking about this and thinking about the sort of contradictions of the U.S. left and the U.S. anti-apartheid movement. And then, of course, that brings me to what I'm talking about at this precise moment, which is that the United States is a country that's not very progressive and historically has not been. And so it should not be a shock to any who are paying attention that the candidates that it throws up for presidential elections are not necessarily the most progressive of us all, which leads me even more to salute Bernie Sanders, who at least has the courage to identify himself with redistribution of the wealth, who had the flexibility to respond to the Black Lives Matter movement by trying to tailor a program concerning police terror and police violence. I think that speaks well for him.
Well, yes, I don't dispute that. But at the same time, he had to be compelled to come to terms with Black Lives Matter, and he had to be compelled to address it. And I see a marked absence of critique of Hillary Clinton from the third party, Green Party, for example. People, and including Bernie Sanders himself, absolutely refuses to tackle Hillary Clinton on issues where, in light ideologically of their political differences, one would see that he has ample opportunity and very solid ground to make note of the difference between him and Hillary Clinton. But he seems to be going along with the program, unwilling to tackle her and unwilling to identify the differences there.
Well, you know, I used to work in the trade union movement, and what you may be identifying is what we in the union movement used to call pork chop unity. That is to say that, you know, people on the staff of the unions and the leadership oftentimes didn't criticize each other because, you know, we were too busy trying to share the pork chops. What I mean by that is that Sanders obviously has some policies that he'd like to apologize for. As I said, endorsing this misadventure in Libya, his position on gun control, to name two, and perhaps he feels that if he opens the door to critiques of Hillary Clinton, well, she, as she has done in these recent debates, will fire back to his detriment. Many of Bernie Sanders' supporters do not necessarily endorse his views on gun control and do not accept his rationale that he's from the state like Vermont, where people tend to have guns, and therefore we need to try to find a halfway solution, which he keeps saying. So, there's reason for Sanders to hold his fire, pardon the expression, with regard to his attack on Senator Clinton. And in any event, there might be a tactical consideration as well, because many of his supporters feel that because of the strength of the white right in the United States, that progressive forces should be rather reluctant to critique and attack each other because they feel that this contributes to a certain kind of disunity that could only help the fortunes of the white right. which after all, I would say, you might recall that in 2012, they got, 60% of the white vote. I was reading just the other day that in 1984 election, Ronald Wilson Reagan got 66% of the white vote. And even though that sector of the U.S. population is diminishing, given the strength of voter suppression and given the attempts thus far rather successful to intimidate the Latino community by unleashing immigration raids and all the rest, that it's perhaps understandable why Senator Sanders and his supporters would like to concentrate their fire on the 1%.
I think it is also worth noting, I feel very strongly that this election year, more than perhaps in recent years, there seems to be a total absence or a near total absence of black political firepower and a leadership that literally is presenting no resistance at all to the status quo in this election and awaiting their orders, their marching orders from the Democratic Party to go out there and just recruit more black voters without the power to exact or extract from any party, whether Republican or Democrat or even the Green Party, any concessions. Do you feel that way?
Well, your point is well taken. I mean, and obviously this is bound up to an extent with the support for President Obama. I think that historians, assuming that we survive climate change, are going to have a field day in assessing the Obama presidency and assessing in particular the extent to which the turbocharging of the white right, which has led to the rise of Donald Trump, is due in any way to a backlash against having the first black president. It's also curious, I feel, that it seems that many of our friends on the left have not been able to walk and chew gum at the same time. That is to say, do a critique of Obama, particularly on questions like Libya, while at the same time critiquing this white backlash. And you may be familiar with the recent story in the London Review of Books by Seymour Hersh, the former reporter for the New York Times and frequent correspondent for the New Yorker, who argues in the London Review of Books that the national security establishment, at least a sector of it in Washington, was so upset with Obama's Syria policy, not necessarily from the right, but from the left, that they began leaking intelligence to the Germans and the Russians that could then be passed on to President al-Assad in Damascus so that he could fight more effectively against al-Qaeda and al-Nusra Front and ISIS. Well, I found this shocking. I mean, first of all, it raises the question as to what extent President Obama has control in Washington. We all know that a president at the end of the day is little more than the chairman of the executive committee of the U.S. ruling elite. And if you've ever chaired a meeting, you know that you either express the will of the body or you resign or you're ousted. And so any president is going to have difficulty corralling the deep state, as they say in Turkey, or the permanent establishment, as they say in other countries. But a question that historians are going to have to grapple with is whether President Obama, given his African ancestry, might have had even more difficulty in corralling other elites, particularly since we know, as a matter of principle in the United States, that because of white supremacy, it's very difficult for a black person to get respect in any sector in the United States of America, including the ruling sector. And I say all that to say that despite the pusillanimous approach of the black political establishment, which in my opinion has yet to recover from the Faustian bargain that was made decades ago, where in return for some paltry anti-Jim Crow concessions, our community would move away from its left-wing and socialist-oriented leadership, such as Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, etc. And I don't think we've yet to recover from that, just like I don't think the trade union movement in the United States has yet to recover from a similar bargain that they made. And what this has led to is that this black political establishment being intimidated, if not overwhelmed, by the power of the white right, and therefore being reluctant to put forward aggressive measures, President Obama has not helped matters because he has told the black community, when black leadership comes to him with specific proposals and demands, that he's not the leader of black America. Well, of course he's not. He's the president of the United States. But when Latinos come to him with proposals and demands, he doesn't say, I'm not the leader of Latino America. So he's really been rather dismissive in a callous sort of way. But then again, you might argue, or some might argue, that he is so intimidated and overwhelmed himself by the power of the white right that he feels that if he were seen to be making concessions to the black community, this would inflame and outrage this community even more. After all, despite the fact that his health care plan, so-called Obamacare, has led to 17 million more people getting insurance that didn't have it before, and has particularly had significant impact in a state like Kentucky amongst poor whites. Despite that, Kentucky just elected a Tea Party governor on the specific premise of overthrowing Obamacare. And the House and the Senate, as you know, are sending to the president's desk yet another proposal to overturn his signature health care proposal, even though a significant percentage of those who would be hurt and wounded would be those in the who are voting for these Tea Party candidates and these white right legislators. So I say all this to say that there are complex reasons why it is that the black political leadership might not have been aggressive as some of us would like them to be. But then again, if they are not able to be aggressive, perhaps they should consider stepping down and resigning and letting some of us who are willing to be aggressive to take their place.
An issue that continues to hound us, of course, is that of terrorism. Could you talk about the impact terrorism has had in 2015 and it continues to have in 2016? The International Institute of Economics and Peace has come up with something called the Global Terrorism Index and said that at this time, terrorism has literally reached its peak, and most of the acts of terror occurring in Muslim-majority countries. How has terrorism factored into both domestic and foreign policy?
Well, domestically, as you well know, these Republicans are trying to terrify the U.S. population. I mean, if you look at the ads that they're running in Iowa, the ads that they're running in New Hampshire, you would think that the United States is on the verge of collapse, not least because there are these Muslim invading armies crossing the Mexican border, perhaps even the Canadian border, willing to snuff out life at the slightest provocation. So on the one hand, there's a certain kind of demagogy related to terrorism, quote-unquote, that obviously we must reject. But at the same time, we must look at this phenomenon historically and recognize, once again, you live in New York. I once lived in New York. I recall in the 1980s on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, there was open recruiting of Arab Americans and black Americans in offices there to go fight in Afghanistan. And we all know that in Afghanistan in the 1980s, Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda in the United States shared the same trench, a policy that backfired spectacularly on September 11, 2001. We all know that the U.S. chief ally, that is to say Saudi Arabia, has within its borders a number of elites who are major funders of al-Qaeda and al-Nusra Front and ISIS. The same could be said for Turkey, a partner of the United States in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, where oil from ISIS-ruled territories on the Syria-Iraqi border is being transported to be sold, with the revenue flowing back to ISIS. And I just mentioned how the national security establishment in Washington, at least a wing of it, was so upset about the U.S. being in bed with these extremist forces that they decided to help President al-Assad. So there's a certain kind of kabuki theater to this so-called war against terrorism, a certain kind of fakery, a certain kind of lack of authenticity. That is to say that we all know that there are those in Washington who, at the slightest whim, will jump in bed with those who otherwise they might call terrorists. That is to say that one of the reasons why there's so much objection to Russia's intervention in Syria is because it's well known that Russia has a Muslim population of about 10 to 15% in the southern reaches of that sprawling nation, that a significant percentage of the forces now aligned with al-Nusra Front and ISIS actually hail from Russia. And some of the neoconservatives have not ruled out the possibility of working with these forces against President Putin in Moscow, who they see as more of an existential threat to the United States' existence, given the fact that he sits on a major nuclear stockpile, than those designated as terrorists. And likewise, with regard to the Uyghur population in western China, which is heavily Muslim, and has within its ranks those who have been seen, at least, as working with ISIS and the so-called Islamic State. There are those in Washington who would like to manipulate that population against Beijing. And that means, of course, that there cannot, at this particular moment, be an all-out kind of conflict with ISIS, because the United States is hedging on the possibility that these forces can be used against Moscow and Beijing, just like they were used in the 1980s in Afghanistan against Moscow. And that's why I think, that's one of the reasons why I think the population is so confused. That is to say, on the one hand, as noted, you have the Republicans who are trying to scare the daylights out of their primary voters by raising the flag of so-called terrorism. And they are helped by episodes such as in San Bernardino, such as in Tennessee, such as in Texas, with the U.S. major who shot many of his comrades. And at the same time, you have a wing of the national security establishment in Washington who are not opposed to collaborating with these very same forces. And so it's little wonder why this continues to be a major issue in U.S. politics.
I want to shift to a very significant development. Just last month, the government of Zimbabwe has decided to adopt China's yuan as its official currency. What is the significance of that move?
Well, it's very significant. First of all, as you know, Zimbabwe doesn't necessarily use a domestic currency. They use the U.S. dollar, the South African rand, and they use other regional currencies from Botswana, for example. And so adding China to the mix should not be surprising, given the fact that China is the world's second largest economy, given the fact that relations between China and Zimbabwe are very close and have been historically, going back to the Liberation War against the white minority regime, culminating in independence in the 1980s, given the fact that President Xi Jinping was just in Harare, Zimbabwe, just a few weeks ago as a prelude to the summit in Johannesburg of leading African presidents and prime ministers, including President Jacob Zuma of South Africa and President Mugabe of Zimbabwe, meeting with the Chinese leadership. I have to be careful in talking about China, because there's this idea afoot that I hear every time I talk about China, that China is the new colonizer in Africa. That is a very curious assessment, because on the one hand, it tends to downplay and understate what the old colonizers did, those who deposited people's ancestors like yours and mine in the Americas and rampaged throughout the continent and set back Africa's development for decades, if not centuries. And so by talking about China in that kind of context, automatically overstates China's impact and understates the impact of the United States, Britain, France, Portugal, Spain, the Netherlands, etc., which is very curious because I hear people who consider themselves to be, quote, black nationalists, unquote, or, quote, progressive, unquote, making such assertions. At the same time, as you may know, I have a particular critique historically of China. I mean, I find it very curious that as I'm doing this research here on the liberation wars in Southern Africa, that you know that one of the reasons why China has been able to advance so tremendously in recent years was because fundamentally it cut a deal with U.S. imperialism after Nixon's trip in the 1970s. And then, as part of the payoff, waged war in Vietnam in 1979 after Deng Xiaoping, the paramount leader, had come to the United States and collaborated with apartheid South Africa and Angola and made all sorts of transgressions as part of its alliance with U.S. imperialism, which ultimately led to so much pressure on the then socialist camp that it collapsed. And now that that's collapsed, now China's in the crosshairs of a certain wing of the U.S. national security establishment. That's the import of another significant development of 2015, the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership that President Obama negotiated with most of the Asian nations, excluding China. In fact, it's aimed at China. And next on his agenda is a transatlantic partnership, that is to say, a virtual merger between the U.S. economies and the European Union, once again aimed at China, even though if you add up the populations of Europe, 500 million, and the U.S., 330 million, it's still about 500 million less than China's population, which gives you an idea of the magnitude of the U.S. challenge. So I say all this to say that we're living through a massive transformation on a world scale, and I don't think I could put it better than it was put in this morning's Financial Times by a Chinese leader who said that the so-called Pax Americana of the post-1945 era is no longer sufficient, as exemplified by these catastrophes in Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan. He says that it's almost like an adult trying to wear a child's clothing, and that's how inappropriate the Pax Americana is. But at the same time, it's unclear what's going to emerge to replace it. There are those who suggest that it will be a Pax China, that is to say China will replace the United States as a leading power, and that's possible. But at the same time, as you know, China has very sharp conflicts with neighboring India. Neighboring India, by the way, also hosted a leader of African presidents and prime ministers weeks before China did, by the way. And we all know of the conflict that China has with Japan. And in fact, there is a de facto alliance between Japan and India that in some ways is targeting China. So it's unclear if China will be able to overcome those obstacles going forward in the 21st century. But in any case, it makes sense for Zimbabwe and other African leaders not to play the game of Washington, not to play the game of some of their erstwhile friends in the United States who are talking about China as a new colonizer, but seeking to work with all forces because given Africa's present state, I don't see any alternative to that.
Well, in this new arrangement with Zimbabwe, we still have a strange gathering of nations because Zimbabwe is doing business with China and India and Japan. Very interesting. But I also note a concentrated effort in the media covering China's economy, and the constant tone has been that China's economy is slowing down. Today, the tone of the stories was that it is now beginning to cause shivers on Wall Street. Is this part of the effort to, in fact, make it a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the fact is that China's economy is slowing down. They suspended stock trading just this morning in China, which then sent ripples out throughout the global economy, hitting Wall Street just as we speak. It wouldn't surprise me if Wall Street suspended trading as a knock-on effect of what's happening in China. But at the same time, we have to be clear that there are those who are very upset about the rise of China. The problem is that there are such close connections between the Chinese economy and the U.S. economy that any kind of warfare, economic or otherwise, the United States wages against China is going to backfire against the United States itself. But we also know that these U.S. rulers tend to be very single-minded in their focus. That's one of the reasons why they could ally with religious zealots in Afghanistan in 1980 and not foresee the inevitable consequences of the religious zealots turning on them. So we cannot rule out the possibility that these U.S. rulers, or at least the dominant wing, will wage a certain kind of warfare against China. Donald Trump, the leading GOP candidate for president, has been talking about slapping a 25 to 45% tariff on all goods coming from China, which could simultaneously sink Walmart, not to mention raise prices for the U.S. working class. And we cannot rule out the possibility that he will seek to execute that maneuver. The slowdown in China, as we know, has affected many of our friends. You can't separate the slowdown in China from the kinds of problems that Nicolas Maduro is having in Venezuela, with the recent 2015 elections leading to gigantic steps forward for the opposition. Obviously, this is going to hamper the program that Chavez, Hugo Chavez, his predecessor, enunciated during his tenure, whereby subsidized petroleum was sent to Haiti and other Caribbean nations and Central American nations. That's going to be on the chopping block now, which is obviously going to have significant impact on the Caribbean and on Central America. You can't separate the slowdown in China from the problems that are taking place in Brazil right now with the President Dilma Rousseff now being subjected to a torturous impeachment process with a slowdown of the economy there because Brazil was exporting iron ore to China, soybeans to China. The relations had gone forward, and now with the Chinese slowdown, the Brazilian economy has slowed down, creating problems. And likewise, the elections in Argentina, where the Peronistas suffered a defeat leading to the election of a pro-Yankee president who has been taking out vengeance against many of his predecessors of progressive policies, including close ties to Cuba. So it's possible to say that on the one hand, there has been a significant Chinese slowdown and that it is having significant impact. I should also mention the slowdown impact on Africa, with Zambian exports of copper being affected, with Angola's export of oil and Nigeria's export of oil to China being affected. So, yes, there has been a slowdown, but at the same time, we have to be careful about accepting Yankee propaganda, particularly in the New York Times, which has been running this series on China, which helps to give velocity to these charges that I just made reference to, that China is now the world's new colonizer.
Well, this is President Obama's swan song year. He makes his exit this year. How do you assess his achievements so far, and what do you think is likely to happen this year as he closes up shop?
Well, it's a mixed bag. I mean, on the positive side of the ledger, I would place what he attempted to do at the Paris Climate Change Summit, the civilian nuclear energy deal with Iran, improvement of relations with Cuba, despite the fact that I would have preferred a single-payer health care reform. I salute what he has tried to do with Obamacare in the face of fierce opposition from the white right. This year, his recent initiative on guns is significant, but we all know that the white right, as Eastern Oregon tends to suggest, has not ruled out the possibility of an armed mass uprising, which is why they are so beholden to the Second Amendment, and is one of the reasons why the New York Times reports this morning that the gun stocks, the share stocks of Colt Industries of Connecticut, Smith & Wesson, and those who manufacture guns have been going through the roof lately. Because the white right is so afraid about guns being confiscated, which I think is ludicrous, they've been buying guns like they're about to go out of style. And so I think at the end of the day, one can say, it reminds me of what Miles Davis once said with regard to playing the trumpet, that he says that if you're playing, it's difficult to say you played a bad note until you play the next note. And I think that that might be appropriate for presidential politics. That is to say, in order to evaluate Obama, we're going to have to see what comes next. And right now, as noted, it seems that what comes next will be a president that is to his right. And if that's the case, that'll make him look better than I am painting him as we speak.
Well, I ask this question all the time, and I would ask it of you. What should this year do to the budding activist?
Come again? Say that again?
What should this year mean to the budding activist?
Oh, it reminds me of what I sent in an email to a young person just the other day who was asking me if he should join a particular political organization. And I said, sure, why not? Because whether you join that political organization or not, the major themes of your existence should be study and struggle. And so likewise, I would say to the seasoned activists, the budding activists, that study and struggle should be our keynotes, not only for 2016, but it should have been for 2015, and it should be for the 21st century.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Gerald, for being with us and for getting us started right. I see you again. It's funny, many times when I talk with you, you're in the library researching your next book. And I look forward to this one. How is your Confronting Black Jacobins going?
Oh, it's going well. I mean, the Haitians love it, which I'm very much pleased about because I think it goes a long way to explaining the plight of Haiti today and the crisis on the border with the Dominican Republic, which is just awful. I should also say that my biography of Paul Robeson, who's, you know, passed away 40 years ago this month in January 1976, that it'll be out this month. And so I look forward to talking to you and your audience about Paul Robeson sooner rather than later.
We look forward to that as well. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it got you started thinking and rethinking about these issues so that when they come up, you have a point of reference. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how this program is resonating with you. Send me a little note. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company and also in Gerald Horn's. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.